Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, coronavirus and the long road ahead. This week, the U.S. passed 60,000 deaths from COVID-19, more than 1 million infected. And my guest, Dr. Michael Osterholm, says we're still in the very early stages of this public health crisis. So exactly what does that mean? And what might our lives look like as scientists race to come up with a vaccine? We talk about these questions and how hopeful he is that we can find therapies to treat the virus. Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. I spoke with him Thursday afternoon. Dr. Osterholm, let's start with the news we got yesterday from Dr. Fauci about this antiviral drug, remdesivir. What do we know about it, and just what does it mean?
Well, right now we're looking for any good news we can find within this pandemic experience. And finding a therapeutic drug that can reduce the occurrence of death or severe disease is obviously good news. I think we're all still waiting to get a better understanding of just what the real impact is. Yesterday, there was also a study published in another medical journal from China, which did not show any benefit, and they were more severely ill patients. And so I think that this is one step towards getting that kind of information that we need to understand what the treatments can do and what they can't do. But I think in the meantime, we'll just have to wait for more information to come out from the NIH on this study. But we're very glad to get this information we did get.
Dr. Fauci said that with remdesivir, you could be discharged from the hospital in 11 days rather than 15 days. And that set me wondering just how important this development really is.
Well, it could be important in the sense that it's not just a matter of how soon you get out of the hospital, but does it also reduce the number of deaths? And I think on one study like this, it's very hard to provide a lot of definition. But we have a number of studies going on with the same drug in which you're looking at different kinds of clinical illnesses. You know, one of the things that happens with patients with COVID-19, some of them develop a condition called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, where their immune system is dysregulated or there's a problem with it. Other individuals who have heart disease type problems that also are important. And so what we don't understand yet is how the drug interacts with the virus, how it interacts with the human body. And so unfortunately, we're going to have to wait for more data. But I mean, the good news is at least we have good news. And right now, we're all really hoping for and searching for good news. So I feel like the NIH is going to do a very good job, an exhaustive job of testing all of these different drugs and giving us the information that we need.
What about the studies going on at Oxford University? How much promise do they hold?
Well, ultimately, the holy grail of defeating this virus and bringing back our lives as we once knew them is going to require a vaccine. We've got to be able to make sure that we don't continue to see new infections occurring. Right now, there are over 100 vaccines that are in development for this particular virus, and they all vary by how they are going to set up our human immune system to take on this virus. One of the first vaccines being evaluated right now is from Oxford University in London. The initial data in which they put this in animals, in monkeys, and then vaccinated them and challenged them with the virus after they'd been vaccinated, it was actually quite successful. So it surely gives us hope that we can find a vaccine that will provide some immunity. The challenge we have with coronaviruses in general is the fact that they may not provide long-term protection, these vaccines, and that almost akin to the flu shot, even if we could buy 6 to 12 months of protection, that by itself would be really helpful in terms of trying to stop this pandemic. But in the end, we have a lot of work to do to figure out, one, can we make effective vaccines? And then when we say effective, how long and how well do they work? And then the other thing is we have to understand that we have to deal with safety issues yet, and that's going to be a big challenge.
Now, how well do the tests performed on monkeys translate to human beings?
We actually think the early studies in these monkeys actually give us a good sense of whether or not the vaccines do provide some immunity. One of the other pieces of good news about these monkey studies, and we're not even talking about vaccines, just the fact that can we challenge these monkeys with the virus, watch them become clinically ill, go through kind of a classic COVID disease like we might see somewhat in humans, and then go back and re-challenge them again with the same virus weeks later. What happened? Guess what? All the monkeys got infected with the initial challenge, and none of them got infected with the subsequent challenge after they had recovered. Again, supporting that immunity does develop even after infection. But as we just talked about with vaccine, the challenge we have is it long-term? How well does it protect over time? And that's what we're still working on. But I'm encouraged, at least with the data we have, that we can develop some sense of immunity with this infection.
So what does that mean, for example, with people in this country who've already had the virus and gotten through it quite well? I have a dear friend, 77 years old, whose health was compromised because of heart problems and diabetes, but got through it. Is he at all at risk, number one, of getting it again? And number two, is he at all at risk of giving it to someone else?
Well, I wish I could provide really definitive answers to all those very good questions, but let me tell you what I do know. One is, first of all, that's great news that your friend has done so well. And I have to believe that based on what we just talked about with immunity, they would not have gotten better had they not had some immunity kick in terms of their response to the virus. So that's a good sign. Number two is that if they were ill, days to weeks ago, it's very likely that they're fully protected now for at least some period of time from getting reinfected. And the third thing is they're not going to be transmitting the virus to others right now. They're the kind of the safest person, you might say, in terms of being around people who have not yet been infected. So the real challenge we're going to have here is finding out two things. One is, why do some people, like your friend who have these underlying conditions, go on and have serious illness and even die? That would give us some knowledge of what to do to try to prevent that from happening. The second thing is, we're going to need to understand over time, how long are they protected? How complete is that protection? And is it going to be like a flu season situation where next year I can still be vulnerable to a virus, even if it hasn't changed that much? And so these are all really important questions you're asking, that this is exactly where science needs to be right now, answering these questions.
We talked a little earlier about Oxford University. Johnson and Johnson said earlier this month it had shaved months off the usual timelines for developing a vaccine and expects to start human testing as soon as September, with possible availability on an emergency basis in early 2021. What does that tell you?
The response to this virus from vaccine work and from drug work is unprecedented. It's remarkable. We are fast-forwarding four seasons into 1 month, and that's the good news for society. The problem with that is we're on virus time right now, not on human time. We actually have a report that's being issued this week from our center, which lays out the likely scenarios for this pandemic to play out. And we think much of the very serious and significant activity, number of cases, number of deaths, is going to potentially increase substantially over the next 3 to 6 months. So a vaccine that shows up in 2021 will still be very welcome. But unfortunately, it will miss out on virus time activity. And so anything we can do to speed things along, to understand if they work, how safe they are, we have to do. And I'm confident we are doing that. We're, as I say affectionately, we're almost throwing the kitchen sink at everything right now. But we have to do that wisely. We need to do it very wisely. We want to make sure that what we do isn't just wasted energy. We have over 100 vaccines right now that are being evaluated. And some of us have said, well, wait a minute, do we need to evaluate all of those?
Wow.
And we take a sampling of some of the different kinds, see which ones are most likely to work, and then concentrate on those. So we have a lot of work to do that way, but I think we're making progress.
Now, 31 states are getting ready to ease restrictions and allow more people to gather at restaurants and social gatherings. How might that affect the development of a vaccine?
Well, we're going to find out that as people come back together, this virus is going to continue to transmit. It's kind of what I call viral gravity. It's there all the time. And what we don't know yet is how much of the variation in number of cases has to do with what we do as humans and how much has to do with Mother Nature. For example, in 1918, that was an influenza pandemic, not a coronavirus, but it's very similar in many ways. And in the spring of 1918, cities like New York and Chicago were hit very hard with spring waves, where cities like Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Minneapolis, Detroit did not have much activity at all. We don't know why. And then the virus went away from Chicago and New York in the spring of 1918, but it came roaring back into all those cities in the fall of 1918. So even as we release people back in society today from these distancing measures, we have to be careful to know whether we're responsible for why things are changing or is it just Mother Nature. But I can say with certain the virus is going to come back. And this is why we need to have a vaccine. We need to have effective drugs. And we're going to have to understand how to, what I say, thread the rope through the needle. How do we make sure that if cases start to increase again, we proportionally limit people's contact without basically destroying society as we know it? That's what is really the important question we have right now.
When you say we have to find out whether it's us or Mother Nature, what do you mean by Mother Nature?
Well, in the case of, as I just gave the example in terms of 1918, we don't know why the cases suddenly disappeared. There was no social distancing. There was no efforts made by humans. And yet, literally for months, there was very little flu activity after the initial spring wave. And then all of a sudden, in late summer of 1918, we saw this major increase again, as if somewhere the virus came out of nowhere. And that's actually happened in other influenza pandemics. Even in 2009, when we had H1N1, which was a much milder influenza pandemic as a whole, the cases first emerged in March and April of that year. We had a spring peak through parts of the United States and other northern latitude countries, and then it disappeared. All of a sudden, in early September, we started to see cases again, well before a vaccine got here, and the activity increased dramatically, peaking in early October. And then again, disappearing before a vaccine really had any impact. We don't know why. And so that's when I say Mother Nature is in charge. That's the part that we have to understand.
So as you think about the development of a vaccine, what are the biggest challenges that lie ahead?
With vaccine right now, I just have to say that one challenge that doesn't exist is an important one to acknowledge is the world is committed to getting this done. I am convinced that there isn't anyone in government, in the private sector, anywhere that has any reluctance to do everything they possibly can. The challenge is, of course, as this new virus that we're dealing with, what history we have with coronaviruses, the family of these viruses, does that immunity, developing an immune response and being protected are difficult to do. And so just for influenza, we'd know much better what to do. We'd know how to make a vaccine. We'd know how to improve the vaccine, but we just don't know here. So I think our biggest challenge is making sure it can work, not just for a short period of time, but for a longer period of time, and making sure it's safe. And that's really what we're concentrating on right now.
So let's say we have a vaccine by early 2021. Who's going to get it? Who's going to be first in line?
That is a very wise, wise question. And that is one of the challenges we have right now is we need to be preparing for all aspects of this vaccine's availability. Not only the research and development to figure out what works, not just lining up manufacturing facilities to make sure it can be made quickly once it's approved, but also how will it be used? Who gets it first? There are going to be 8 billion people on the face of the earth that are going to want this vaccine right now, which we know we won't be able to supply. Does it make a difference which country the vaccine is first found to be effective and it's licensed in China or it's licensed in England or the United States? Who gets it? Is it that country's population? Do we vaccinate older people first, people with underlying health problems? There are a lot of questions yet. And so this part of our work, to lay all of that out, to create a very detailed roadmap for how this is going to be done, and so that when the vaccine is found to be hopefully safe and effective, that handoff to manufacturing is smooth and quick. And the same thing is true once manufacturing has provided us with the vaccine. We need to have a very smooth and quick handoff to the public health and medical communities to make sure that this vaccine is delivered in an effective and an equitable way. We want it to be fair. We can't just have the high-income countries getting this vaccine and leaving the rest of the world without. So that's going to take some work yet to come to that consensus about what we do.
So how many of the really big companies are already involved in this?
Virtually every major manufacturing company that works with vaccines is involved in some phase of the work right now. There are those companies that are basically smaller and very mobile type companies. They can act quickly to help get the initial vaccines into research, but ultimately it's going to take a large vaccine pharmaceutical company to do the manufacturing and help get the distribution out. So I would hope to think that it won't be just one company, that like a wartime effort, if we find one or two vaccines, we may end up finding a way to have multiple companies help manufacture it, deliver it, and get it out quickly. You know, when we have a bad fire somewhere, we don't just take one fire truck. We take as many as we need. And we're going to need as many vaccine manufacturing fire trucks in this situation as we can get.
More of my conversation with Dr. Michael Osterholm after a short break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's director at the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. The U.S. passed over 60,000 deaths this week and over 1 million cases. What do those numbers mean to you?
I think to give people a sense of what keeps me up at night. Number one is that we have given a lot of thought to this before. In 2017, I published a book, Deadliest Enemies, Our War Against Killer Germs, in which I laid out a scenario of what an influenza pandemic would look like that started in China in a modern world. And if you just take the word influenza out and put in coronavirus, it's unfolded exactly as I had written in the book. And the problem is there's still much more of the chapter yet to unfold. If you think about the fact in the United States today, we estimate that between 5% and 15% of our population has been infected. That's it. And we've been through a lot of pain, suffering, and death already. It's going to take at least 60% to 70% of the population to be infected and then develop immunity before this virus will slow down its transmission. It's what we call herd immunity. Now, we could achieve that by vaccine if we get that first. That would be ideal. But if we don't, that virus will get there. Now, imagine if only 5 to 15% of the people have been infected to date with all the pain, suffering, and death we've had, and we have to get to 60 or 70%. That's what keeps me up at night, knowing that that's ahead of us. And that's exactly what happened in the pandemics of the past. If you look at 1918, you look at the ones that really had impact on society, they did just what we're suggesting might happen.
So what kind of death toll could we have?
You know, when we look at just very simplistic numbers, and what I mean by that is, you know, we've had all these very sophisticated models that have been developed, and models are kind of black box exercises where whatever you put into them will give you the results. So if you assume it's going to last 18 months or 6 months, that's a challenge. What I do is just say, just take a step back. Just say there's 330 million people in the United States. If half of them get infected, you know, that's basically 1,600,000 roughly. And if you think about that 160 million people, parts that out so that about 80% have mild, moderate disease. That's what we would expect to see. Many of them not even sick at all. That leaves about 20% left out of that 160 million that would need medical care. About half of those would need hospital care. So about 10% of the 160 million. About 5% will need intensive care medicine. And about 1% to 1.5% will die. And if you add those numbers up, that's 800,000 to 1.6 million people that could die if we see that. Now, I used a 50% infection rate. You can put it in any number you want. We know that there are many people who are missed who are milder illnesses. Again, put that in there. But I would just leave people with one last observation. Nothing since 1918, nothing, this I can't emphasize enough, has done what this disease has done. COVID-19, the last week of February, was not in the top 75 causes of death in the United States, not even in the top 75. By last month, it was the number one cause of death in this country every day. And that's exceeding heart disease, cancer, accidents, all of that. And so this gives you a sense of what it can do. And it gives you a sense of where we've been with only 5 to 15% of the population previously being infected. So, Diane, you can see we have a long road ahead of us yet to get to that herd immunity standpoint if we don't have a vaccine.
So you're saying we're in the very early stages.
You know, I have likened it in my simple mind to saying we're really only in the second inning of a 9-inning game. And we have to understand that this is going to last potentially for months. And this is not unusual. Other pandemics like this in history have lasted the same period of time. And the difference with this one could be a vaccine. If we can get it quick enough and we can have an effective and safe vaccine, we can surely head this virus off. But that's not going to happen in the next months. And that's what we're all up against right now. And we just have to be honest with our society and say, this is why we're so concerned. You know, I hear people now saying, oh, this has been overblown. This isn't any worse than the flu season. And, you know, that's not true. It is. And we have to understand that.
What about testing? What's your view?
The testing issue right now is one that's a challenge. I just had an op-ed piece in the New York Times where I laid out the challenge of testing. But at the outset, let me say, I am a very strong supporter of testing, very strong. It's critical. What we need to do in this country is have a PCR test, testing for the virus test, that works well. And it should be available for every person on this given day who is clinically ill. If you're sick, or you have symptoms suggestive of this, or you're a contact of a case, you should be able to get testing right now. Not tomorrow, not next week, or not deferred. Get testing. If you're a healthcare worker or a first responder, and you have some mild symptoms and you don't know if you have this disease, you should be able to get tested because you don't want to be transmitting to people in the healthcare setting or those who are working as first responders. So we have to have that kind of testing. Unfortunately, the testing situation is a mess. When the FDA opened up testing because of the inability to get testing initially from the CDC, they created the wild, wild west of testing. Today, if I want to test for these viruses or antibodies, all I have to do is send a sheet into the FDA that basically says I can do it. And we know we have many tests out there right now that are performing horrible, horrible. And in fact, one senior FDA official 2 weeks ago said most of these antibody tests are crap, his own words. And so I think that we need to pull back on that and make sure only the best tests are available and are being used. Finally, we just have to know this antibody test is not the same as the virus test. In many cases, it'll give you a false positive reading. if I were to apply this test right now in the state of Minnesota, for example, half of all the positives I'd find would be false positives. Now, how do I tell a healthcare worker you have an antibody? Oh, but by the way, you have a 1 in 2 chance it's not real. So we have to do a lot of work on the testing. But again, I want to emphasize testing for the virus is critical. It should be available immediately. Everybody who needs it should be able to get it. And that should be our goal.
What do you think might have happened if we had taken the WHO test right from the beginning?
I am like many public health people that will second guess and challenge organizations like the WHO in terms of what they did or didn't do. I have to say, our group probably called this as early as any organization in the world that it was going to be a pandemic. We put out a statement on January 20th saying that this would be a pandemic. But I have to say, when you have a respiratory transmitted virus like this, that's very hard to stop. It's like trying to stop the wind. And so I'm not sure that there was any human mistake that meant the difference between stopping this or not stopping it. I think how we responded could have slowed it down and given us much better opportunities to be better prepared in some places. But I don't think that anybody failed on stopping it. I worry about today that from a WHO perspective, who's there to help the low and middle income countries? We're getting reports right now of some of these countries in Africa and South America that they're every bit as bad as Wuhan, New York, or Milan ever was. And yet they have virtually no resources. So I do worry about the impact. And this is where WHO, again, has to play a key role, helping to support countries that are otherwise not in the headlines every day.
How different might this story be here in the United States under different leadership?
Well, first of all, leadership is critical. I mean, your whole show for all these years has been about leadership. And that's the question you ask. That's the question you demand. That's the point of many of the things you do is who's leading. And you've had a lot of leaders on your show that way. We need leadership today desperately. We're going to go through some very rough times ahead. I so much hope that we can have the FDR-like fireside chats, that we can have the Winston Churchill who will tell us we have some really rough times ahead of us, but this is what we're going to do to get through it, and we are going to get through it. We are going to get through it. And I think that kind of leadership right now cannot be overstated. Second of all, you know what? We're going to be making this up as we go, and we will make mistakes. I don't want to hear anymore about all the successes, whether they are or not. I want to hear about what we're not getting done and what we're going to do about it to get it done. And know that that's not a criticism. That's just good planning. You know, a general on the battlefield doesn't just sit there and tell everybody all the good things. They're really good generals are the ones that figure out what's not going well and fixes it. That's what we need right now. So between the moral leadership of that FDR fireside chat voice and then just the logistics and understanding what we need to do is going to be really critical. And then the ability to say, I don't know. There are things sure we don't know. I want to hear somebody tell me what they don't know, but I want to hear what they're going to do to find out. That to me is where I hope we have better leadership.
At the same time, we've heard the president's son-in-law say, we've done a fabulous job on this. I mean, I, for one, question that. I, for one, cringe when I hear him say, make a statement like that, which, according to what we're seeing, certainly doesn't seem true. How do you react?
Well, you know, Diane, I have served roles in the last 5 presidential administrations, including this one where I, for a year, was assigned State Department as a citizen. I've served in the Minnesota Department of Health under 2 Democratic governors, 2 Republican governors, 1 independent governor. And, you know, I've always looked at myself as just a private in the public health army. My job is to serve whoever is there to the very best of my ability. So, you know, this comment is surely not meant to be partisan. But I can tell you that the kind of organizational leadership, the strategic planning, and the kind of efforts that we need right now, we're in short supply. You and I both are dear close friends with Tony Fauci. All I can say is thank God he's there. That is a big, big plus. That helped, but we need an entire team to help back him up. And right now, I don't care if you're man or woman. I don't care what your race, religion, creed, anything is. I just want to know who can bring to this terrible, terrible situation the direction, the leadership, and the courage to address it honestly, fairly, and succinctly to the public. That's what I'm looking for, and I think we have work to do.
Before we close, is there anything further you'd like to say to our listeners?
You know, I think that in the absence of fireside chats, we need really critical voices that can communicate to the public what's happening. I can't say this strongly enough. People like yourself are really important because you do provide the balance, the basic information that we need to hear. And an informed public is going to make a lot better decisions. They're going to support the decision so much more if they have this kind of information. So I just hope people like you, who have such credibility, who are so well-respected and listened to, just keep addressing this topic. Don't stop, because it's going to be a long haul, and we're going to need you. And what we don't need are the fringes. We don't need way to this side or that side. Just as the old TV show Dragnet used to say, remember Detective Friday, you say, just the facts, ma'am. You know, I love that. And if you can help us get that across, that'll be very, very important.
Dr. Alistair Holm, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Diane.
That was Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's director at the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And that's all for today. But before I sign off, I have a quick announcement. Starting in May, I'll be hosting a virtual monthly book club. The first will be held May 27th. We'll be discussing The Plot Against America by Philip Roth. The live Zoom event is made possible by WAMU members, and the discussion will be available to all on YouTube. Stay tuned to dianerain.org for details. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you're staying safe and staying well. Join us again next week. I'm Diane Rain.